Welcome to Leonard Lopate at Large. I'm Leonard Lopate. Peter Asher was still a teenager when his younger sister, the actress Jane Asher, introduced him to her new boyfriend, an up-and-coming musician named Paul McCartney. That meeting would alter the course of his life because A World Without Love, a McCartney song that the Beatles had rejected, gave Asher's act, Peter and Gordon, a number one hit in both the United States and the UK. He went on to become the head of A&R at the Beatles' record label, Apple, where, among other things, he discovered James Taylor. Mr. Asher's new book from Henry Holt Macmillan, called The Beatles from A to Z, an alphabetical mystery tour, is a whimsical look back at the recorded work of the Fab Four, peppered with anecdotes about Mr. Asher's life as a Grammy-winning producer who's worked with everyone from Linda Ronstadt to Robin Williams. I'm very pleased to welcome him to our show now. Hi.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here. Thank you for having me.
You write that your sister Jane Asher's first few acting jobs were on TV shows that you were also cast in.
That was one of the early ones, yes. We both started, actually, in films. We did our first film separately, but when I was 8 and she was 6. Mm. And then a year or so later, we were in some TV shows. The old Robin Hood black and white TV series with Richard Greene.
I remember. I used to watch
it. It was kind of a hit in America. Mm. I was on by myself as Prince Arthur. And then after that, I'd done 4 or 5 episodes that way, we were invited back to play a pair of sibling peasant children whose father had been wrongly arrested by the sheriff when we were going to Robin for help. And that's actually the only thing we ever ended up doing together.
He even appeared with Boris Karloff in a TV series called Colonel March of Scotland Yard in 1956.
That's
when
true.
You were 12.
Yes.
Do you remember anything about that actor that
I
most
do.
Of us just
no,
think
nice.
About as Frankenstein?
He was very unhorrifying. He was charming and soft-spoken. He played a detective in the show, and he was quite worried because there was one scene where somebody was trying to poison me, the innocent child, and and he had to smash a glass of milk out of my hand before I drank from it with his cane. Mm. And I remember he was quite concerned. I thought it was exciting. I had one of these, you know, those exploding glass things. But they used the stuntman's hand for that shot. But there was a moment when he had to strike in my general direction. And he was quite concerned about it, and I thought it was totally cool. But, of course, I'd never seen any of his movies because I was at an age when we're not allowed to see horror films.
In fact, in England in those days, had rating systems, and they really protected kids.
Yes, it would be X-rated, which now means generally solely pornographic, but X then applied to horror or sexy or both.
What
or
was it
horrific
that,
sex.
What was it that originally drew you to music? Wasn't your mother a music professor? Was that?
Yes, my mother was an oboe player. She played in several of the major orchestras, and then she ended up being an oboe professor at the Royal Academy of Music. So I grew up surrounded by classical music. My father, who was an eminent physician, but was also a good amateur pianist. So there was music all over the place.
Perhaps your mother's most famous student was George Martin, who went on to produce the Beatles.
It was a bizarre coincidence, yeah, but yes.
Did
Before
she
any of us met George in a Beatle context, she had taught him the oboe.
And did she ever talk about him as a student with you when
later on,
your career developed?
Yes, later on she said he was good. And that we actually, there's a documentary about George in which they put my mother and George back together to have a cup of tea together, and she asked him if he still played and whether he was practicing and things like that. It was entertaining.
What do you recall about your first meeting with Paul McCartney?
I don't actually remember the specific moment when I first met him. I think, you know, Jane had met all the Beatles when she had been invited to be a sort of celebrity guest reviewer and go to one of their, I think, the very first concert.
Well, she was 2 years younger than you. She must have been very young.
I suppose. When did they come down to London? Let's see. That would have been 63 or something, mm-hmm. I suppose. And so she was born in 46.
And you were 19.
That's right. So she was probably 17. Yeah. And she was invited by this magazine, the Radio Times, actually, the BBC publication, to go and see them and write a review, which she did. And that's when she met them all afterwards. And I think I met them actually all together. My recollection is that Jane and I went down to meet them at a pub somewhere. At the time when they could still be in a pub and not be, you know, attacked. And I think I met them all then and then got to know Paul more, obviously gradually, much more closely. And eventually, as you know, he was around the house so much that our parents offered him use of the guest room on the top floor of the house. So he kind of moved in with us for a couple of years.
And that was 1963. They must have been pretty open-minded to allow something like that.
Well,
especially since he was seeing your sister.
Yes, I suppose. I mean, it didn't seem it was all very, very proper. But you know, he was no question. He was in the guest room. But they were open-minded in the sense, when I look back on it, that they liked him and welcomed mm-hmm. him into our home, in the same way that when Jane, at the age of 15, I think, had decided she was definitely going to be an actress and did not need to go to school anymore and quit school, they supported her in that. And indeed, when I quit university, I was a philosophy student at King's College London and left, you know, because we had a big hit record in America and in England. So they were very tolerant, in retrospect.
Do you remember when you first saw Paul and John Lennon working on songs together?
Yes, I mean, because it wasn't that much. I think it may even have been only this one occasion. I never wanted to paint an artificial picture that I spent tons of time hanging out with them while they wrote the hits. You know, I wish I was a co-writer on every one of them, but sadly, absolutely not. I had nothing to do with it whatsoever. But there was one particular occasion back when they were writing a lot of the stuff directly together, eye to eye, as they put it. And that was when... John came over. In the basement of the house was a little music room, which my mother used it very occasionally to give private oboe lessons. So it was a tiny room with a small upright piano, very small, and a two-person sofa and a music stand, and that was all. And my mum had told Paul when he moved in that he could use that piano whenever he needed a piano. And on this particular occasion, John had come over, and they were writing downstairs together. And Paul called up the stairs after couple of hours to my bedroom and asked if I wanted to come down and hear the song they had mm-hmm. just finished. So that particular occasion is stuck in my mind because they sat, interestingly, side by side on the piano bench, no guitars, even though it ended up eventually being a guitar song, and played this brand new song they just finished called I Want to Hold Your Hand, and asked me what I thought of it. So that mm-hmm. certainly burned itself into my memory without doubt. And you kind of go, am I going crazy, or is this the best song I've ever heard in my life?
Oh, you really liked it.
And that was great. And the sign of that is that your actual reaction is to ask them to immediately play it again, which of course means it's a hit. And the other thing that means it's a hit is they were very happy to play it again. They knew what they'd got, you know. So it was that. I remember that occasion particularly.
And you were also present at the moment that Paul learned the song had gone to number one in the United States.
I remember him talking about it immediately as it was happening, as it happened. It was a phone call, as I remember, from Brian Epstein, letting them know that it had gone to number one. And we got a very similar phone call, of course, some months later, 6 months, I suppose. I don't know. Somebody could figure it out. When our record went to number one. And in both cases, one of the major elements of our reaction, significantly, was not just the number oneness of it, but the fact that now we would definitely get to go to America. We'd idolized America our whole lives, you know, not just the music, but we were jealous of America in its entirety. It was the land of plenty. It was technicolor and shiny, and we were black and white and depressed and bomb sites and rationing, and, you know, yeah. We'd had enough of all that. And so
there were still ruins from World War II
bomb
in
sites
the 60s. Everywhere.
No question. We had rationing until 1956. People forget how long it took to recover, and thanks in part to America's help, of course, and Marshall Plan and all that stuff. So yes, it meant a lot to us, and above all, it meant we would, you know, I had copies of Downbeat in my bedroom with the jazz clubs I was going to go to when I got there. I knew I would somehow.
In England, you just simply had Ronnie Scott's, which you couldn't have joined if you were underage because of alcohol.
I went to Ronnie Scott's a lot. I suppose it could have just...
I was a member.
It could have just been when I was 18, mm-hmm. but I used to go all the time. So I don't know quite how that worked, whether they were just not strict or what. I used to go and see, obviously visiting American jazz musicians when I could afford it. But I would go and see... I first made friends with Dudley Moore at Ronnie mm-hmm. Scott's, and he was a pianist I much admired, very much in the Errol Garner tradition. And a lot of great English jazz players, some of whom I ended up using on Peter and Gordon records, just once I figured out that, you know, if I'm making these records, I can choose who plays on them. So I had Tubby Hayes playing on a Peter and Gordon track and playing a
Tubby Hayes,
solo.
A great tenor player.
Great, great tenor player. Yeah.
Well, England had its own popular music traditions, but at this point, all of everything that was being done in England, at least the big hits, was influenced by the Americans. And, of course, American music was everywhere.
Yes. I mean, starting with skiffle, of course, which was a combination of folk music and blues and all that stuff. Everyone had a skiffle group. We all loved American music of all kinds, particularly rhythm and blues, of course, caught on big time. And everybody began as a cover band. I mean, you're going to remember the Beatles. Not only, you know, before they started writing songs, which they turned out to do rather well, but before that time, they were only singing American music. I don't think they sang one British song.
Mr. Postman, songs like that. Didn't they do?
They did
the Marvelettes originally.
Of course they did Twist and Shout, Mr. Postman, you know, all R&B, You Really Got a Hold on Me, you know, Money. They did tons of American songs. And the weird part was when they became hits in America, like there were a whole lot of U.S. fans who thought Twist and Shout was a Beatles song, you know, and it wasn't. And the same with, you know, the Stones played all Muddy Waters and Arthur Alexander and you know, all R&B stuff that, and Jimmy Reed, stuff a lot of America didn't even know about.
They named themselves after a blues line, Rolling Stones.
Of course they did, yes, absolutely.
What do you think it was about those early Beatles hits like I Want to Hold Your Hand or She Loves You that led to such an ecstatic reaction all over the world?
Well, they were, you know, they were great records. They were a great band. I mean, hearing them back in the day, even hearing them that day, both playing the piano, you realized how good they were. I mean, they sang incredibly well. They sang loud, probably from all the years in the clubs in Germany where you had to. They locked together perfectly. Their intonation was extraordinary and is on all those records, which were one take vocals. You know, they were really, really good. And on top of that, of course, they had this personality and this look, and the fact that the four of them were like the perfect storm of talent and appearance and style, and not just musical style but personal style. George was the quiet one, John was the acerbic sort of mordant wit one, Paul was the charmer, you know, and everybody loved Ringo, and everyone's mother and everyone's kids loved Ringo. And he was a great drummer, an underrated drummer. So, you know, you cannot overstate what an extraordinary coincidence of looks and style and music and attitude the Beatles were. And particularly with the help from, you know, George Martin musically, with Brian Epstein saying, no, don't wear your scruffy clothes, put the suits on, the mums will love you. Mm-hmm. Everybody did their job exactly right.
Do you think it also helped that they worked things out in Munich?
If
they had done it in England, maybe they would have felt more constrained at times.
Possibly. I don't know. See, I never went to Germany at that time. I went to the Reeperbahn very much later, and it was still a fairly naughty district. But you know, I can only imagine that doing your growing up and your musical growing up in such circumstances where you were, as you say, out of British view, but, you know, could get up to all kinds of mischief and all kinds of musical invention and get away with it and have time of your life.
You were also present when McCartney put the final touches on another classic Beatles song, I'm Looking Through You. What was his songwriting process?
I don't know. Again, you see, I'm always so anxious not to overclaim. The songwriting process is a magical one and a mystery, and even songwriters can't tell you how it works. They all say, I don't know, I just, you know, I did it. And in the case
sometimes
of
a phrase it gets them excited, or sometimes they're playing doodling on the piano.
And of course, in the case of Yesterday, as you know, he just woke up with the whole thing fully formed in his head, musically, not lyrically. And that was in our house. My mother was one of the first people to hear that song because he woke up and was asking everybody who knew anything about music what it was. He said, what is this song that's stuck in my head? And finally, he became convinced that he'd written it only because nobody else had. It was a moment because people often ask, did you see them write songs? And the only tiny hint of that was he happened to be sitting in my room playing a guitar, and he was figuring out some issue with the bridge of that song, that Love Has a Nasty Habit of Disappearing Overnight bit. And he fixed something in the lyrics in that line, I think, and I can't remember what it was before he fixed it, because now it's perfect and we all know it. He fixed something, and I kind of went, oh, that's how it's done. But that's the only time I actually saw an actual writing moment. Mostly I got to hear stuff after it was done.
Do you think that that songs are different if they're composed on the piano or on the guitar?
You'd think so, wouldn't you? And I think the answer is yes. But the
because
very
the
fact,
guitar would be more rhythmic, wouldn't it?
But the very fact that I Want to Hold Your Hand was written on the piano, I know, and yet turned out to be a major guitar song. That whole da-da-da-da-da bit would have been left hand on the piano. You know, probably in octaves, mm-hmm. if you could play it that way, which Paul probably could. And whereas it became a guitar lick. So I'm not sure. You know, the answers I would guess would be yes. But actually, I think if with a great writer, maybe you could be easily convinced. Yesterday, for example, sounds fine on both, you know. I'm not even sure what he wrote that on. I first heard it on guitar, but he could have written that on the piano too. So it does make a difference because you fall into certain, you know, the guitar, you know, there's certain things on a guitar that fall under your fingers. If you're in D, a sus chord becomes way more obvious and easy than if you're in some other keys. So
yeah. You fall into certain patterns.
But exactly. But, you know, in the piano, I mean, if I play the piano, I'm playing everything in C anyway. So because I'm terrible, I can't play the piano.
So. I'm speaking to Peter Asher, who's done pretty good despite the fact that he can't play the piano. On top of his incredible musical career, now there's a book called The Beatles from A to Z. He also is on radio, and we'll talk about that sometime down the line. His book is published by Henry Holt and Company and Macmillan. You write that although you were close friends with Paul, you were a bit intimidated by John Lennon. What were some of your first interactions with John like? Was he difficult?
He was opinionated, and he didn't brook dissent very, very readily. He was super smart, but he liked to kind of be the authoritative voice in the conversation, I think. You know, I didn't know John ridiculously well. I didn't spend days with him or anything, but we did, you know, have dinner together several times, and I've got to visit them all together sometimes. And he was the one most likely to make a remark that would nowadays be called a put down. You know. He would say something negatively flavored, and you'd see him do it.
Sarcastic
and sort of mordant, and you'd see him do it to someone else, and you'd kind of go, "Oh, I'd rather not have that directed at me." So, you know, I think I'll be a little bit cautious, you know, in how I talk. And I remember having a couple of arguments with John because if you did actually go, "No, I don't think that's right," you know, in the conversation, he would bristle, you know, because he wasn't very used to people saying that because he was John Lennon. And the more he became John Lennon, the more he would just say things and people would go, "That must be true. Yeah. John Lennon's telling me," you know. So if he actually went, "I think you're wrong," it was like a woo, you know, and you never knew quite what was going
to
happen.
I'll get to this in a moment, but his strong opinions is one of the reasons why you wound up with your first hit song. But anyone who's seen the film A Hard Day's Night has an idea of what it must have been, or might have been like anyway, to hang out with the Beatles in 1964. Was that film an accurate description? I realize it was exaggerated.
Yes, I would say exactly so. It was an exaggerated version of what it was actually like. You know, I remember one of the times I hung out with all four of them was when we came to New York when Apple began, and we took that whole row of rooms at the Plaza Hotel because they had a whole bunch of suites and rooms on some floor that all connected. So it was like a railway train. You could run through in 10 rooms, you know, and there was all kinds of chaos going on. And we were having a lot of fun. So that was the closest I ever came to be in a Beatles on film kind of situation.
And there was chaos in the lobby.
It was chaos everywhere. Exactly.
By this point, your own act, Peter and Gordon, was starting to take off. And you describe your style as more folk than rock, despite the growing success of the Beatles.
Well, it was at the beginning. You see, I mean, we began as an acoustic duo. And when we got signed by EMI, the guy who signed us, Norman Newell, I believe, saw us in the folky mode. Indeed, one of the songs, for example, he'd picked out when he signed us. He'd picked several songs from the act he'd seen us do in this club. And 500 Miles, our version of the old American folk standard, was one of his picks. He thought our version sounded beautiful and could be like a hit. So I think he was imagining us being, as it were, you know, the English Kingston duo or Peter and Paul without Mary or something like that. But, you know, that all disappeared when we actually cut Well With Our Love. And by the end of the session, it was clear that we were going to be pop stars, not folkies.
You had started performing with Gordon Waller while you were still in grade school. So you'd been working together for a while.
I guess, I'm not sure what grade school is. I get the system muddled up.
I guess it's high school.
It would have been high school, uh-huh. But I suppose we were at Westminster School together, which is what in England is called a public school, which is a whole other story.
In 2014, you told Variety that John Lennon had rejected A World Without Love for the Beatles because he thought the first line, "Please lock me away," was laughable.
I think that's one of the reasons.
Couldn't they have just simply changed the line?
I suppose so, but I think Paul probably liked it because it was good. Yeah. You know,
did he play any part in your recording of it?
No, the pre-production. He had nothing to do with any of it. Paul or John, neither actually. Mm. I mean, Paul obviously had a role in the pre-production in that he finished the song and gave us the whole song, but he wasn't at the session or had nothing to do. And John had no involvement with that song whatsoever.
And then you must have played it for him at some point.
The record, yes.
Yeah. Was he pleased?
He liked it, yes. He thought it was good. And he turned out to be right because it went to number one. And everybody loved it.
He also wrote Nobody I Know, follow-up, specifically for Peter
yes,
and Gordon?
You see, that's an interesting point, if I can digress for a second, because people often ask, you know, how did you get so many cool songs out of the Beatles? Well, the first song was a particular story. It was an existing song. I'd heard it. The Beatles weren't going to do it. Nobody else had done it. Paul hadn't finished it. John laughed at it and so on. So I said, I really like it. You know, look, we've got a record deal now. Can we give it a go? And he said, yes.
Please Lock Me Away is a grabber. It seems to me that is the kind of opening line you want to a song.
So you're telling John Lennon he was wrong. this is risky business.
Too late now. But
he can't get you now. No. But a bolt of lightning, I'm zipping down. But the songs after that, it's worth pointing out that the Beatles took the job of songwriter very seriously. One of the questions we all got asked in the interviews back in that era, without fail, including the Beatles, was, what are you going to do when this is all over? Mm-hmm. Because there was an absolute conviction that a career in pop music was a couple of years, and then you'd go back to being a plumber or a milkman or whatever you were before. And when the Beatles answered that question on several occasions, they said, we will be songwriters. That to them was a more long-term, more kind of respectable profession. They admired not only Elvis and Eddie Cochran and the rock heroes, they admired Goffin and King, Lieber and Stoller, Mann and Weill. They thought that was a proper job. So, and one of the songwriters' beliefs, as a sort of the songwriters' union, as it were, is if you write a number one record, you don't want somebody else writing the follow-up. Because the follow-up is going to do pretty well, whatever it is, you know, because radio automatically plays the follow-up to a number one record to see if people like it. So when we came back from our first venture to America, when More Without Love was number one all over the world, we had plenty of songs submitted to us by a lot of major songwriters, including, happily, Paul McCartney, who wrote Nobody I Know, complete, finished, with a bridge, and off we went. And he wrote several songs for us after that.
Well, I Go to Pieces. Did he write that? Because it sounds like a Beatles song.
It does a bit, but you know who wrote that? Del Shannon.
Really? Oh.
Really.
Well, by then, of course, the Beatles were influencing Americans as well.
Yes, but this particular song Del had written and thought wasn't right for him, and he played it to us on the road in Australia. We were touring with him in Australia, and we loved it. And he'd actually originally intended it for The Searchers, another excellent English band, who mistakenly turned it down. I'd overheard this effort by him to plug it to The Searchers and asked him if we could learn it, and he said yes. And so our songs came from various sources. One of our big American hits was that song Lady Godiva, a very silly song written by Mike Leander, a very good songwriter who has a Beatles connection of which you may or may not be aware. But an interesting footnote is the only Beatles orchestral arrangement that George Martin didn't write was She's Leaving Home, which is a beautiful, spectacularly good arrangement that was written by Mike Leander, an excellent composer and arranger, who managed to arrange something as subtle and beautiful as that string arrangement and then go ahead and write a song as silly as Lady Godiva. But they were both hits.
Did Paul write I Don't Want to See You Again?
Yes,
he did. And Woman?
Yes, he did.
You also attended several Beatles recording sessions. They're known for their creativity in the studio. What was the process in the studio like, and was it something that influenced the two of you?
I would say no, it didn't influence us because it couldn't. Because what the Beatles did, of course, was start off doing everything they were told, as we all did. So when they first made the first record, they set up, the engineers set everything up and how it was done.
And George Martin was in control.
And they got, you know, whatever it was, that whole album done in a day. Because that in that era, you know, the men in white coats literally would come in and set things up. This is how we record a guitar. This is where the Fairchild Limiter goes on these settings, on these knobs. And when you mix down, you put the faders here and the overall compressor here, and that's it. And you weren't allowed to change anything. And gradually, as they realized that they suddenly had power, you know, they could walk over to the Fairchild compressor, which is another lecture series, and go... And, you know, go, but what happens if you turn the knob all the way up? And they'd all go, ha, no, you can't do that. And all the drums started sucking and everything. And they went, this is great, you know. So we that didn't influence us because it wasn't allowed to. We never, I think only the Beatles entered that realm.
And they got very experimental.
Being able to do whatever they wanted to do. And they did. I mean, we were always trying to make our records sound different and better, we all of us, and make them sound specifically more American. You know, Paul was always fighting, as we were on our records, for more bass. We always wanted more bass on the records. And they would go, no, no, this is the limit. You know, you cannot have more bass than that. It's physically impossible. And so we would bring in like a Motown record, you know, Four Tops record or something. You go, but listen to this.
Yes.
And this has got more bass.
They'd crank go, up the bass.
And they go, oh, but that's all distorted. We would go, yes. You know? So that, you know, it was an ongoing battle. And the Beatles won that battle. Nobody else ever really did.
Shelley Yakis, is that how you pronounce his
yes.
name?
Yes.
He was Yakis, the recording engineer, recently told a story on the Gear Club podcast about John Lennon telling him that the drums on All You Need Is Love consisted of Ringo playing drumsticks on an upright bass being held up by one of the other Beatles. So,
I don't know.
Well, the point is that they were trying a lot of everything.
Oh, they definitely did. I mean, there was one thing where John... What's the famous one where John originally wanted to record the vocal while being swung by a rope around the studio? And in the end, I think that led
swung
to...
Swung by a rope.
Really, he wanted it to go around in circles. And I think that's when they ended up realizing they could do that with a Leslie speaker, which they did. And I would think it was the first time people put vocals through a Leslie, which sounds great.
Now, you've done some recording with Ringo as an engineer, and you said earlier he's underrated. What do you think makes his sound so distinctive, and what do you make of the fact that Bernie Pretty Purdy, who's one of the greatest session drummers of all time, once told me that he was brought in to overdub some of the drum parts on many of the early
Beatles records. He tells everybody that, and I personally, my instinct is that's nonsense. I don't know. I mean, why would he lie?
He's on some of the greatest. He is considered one of the greatest drummers in the history of pop music.
I understand. You've done it. You've hired the hit maker. He used to have a sign that he put up next to his drum kit. You've done it. You've hired the hit maker, and he's brilliant. And there's the famous Purdy shuffle and all that. No, I have no idea why he would make that up, or whether he's deluded. But my belief, and I have no knowledge, no evidence, but except that I think there would be evidence if it were true, and there isn't any.
Ringo did influence a lot of drummers after him.
Oh, Ringo influenced everybody massively, of course. I mean, that's the thing, that you'll find listeners who go, oh, Ringo's not such a great drummer, by which I know what they mean, because at the time, to be a great drummer, you had to be Buddy Rich or something and play a billion licks. And Ringo, the thing about Ringo is he would design the drum part in conjunction with his bandmates. I mean, Paul would have suggestions and so on, but he would work out a drum part that fit the song. He wanted to play for the song. If you think of the number of tunes where he instinctively goes to a regular, you know, boom, boom, chuck, boom, 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 chuck, it's rare. Mm-hmm. You know, it's for Ringo to do that for any length of time is like odd, because usually there's a great, you know, like the beginning of Come Together, any of those fantastic parts. And yes, he played differently because he's, you know, left-handed drummer playing a right-handed kit and those things. He played the hi-hat side to side, which gave it a particular swishy kind of sound. You know, and he kind of took all that for granted. I remember one of the sessions I was producing with Ringo playing, and we were recording the rhythm section, and I told him how great the drum sounded. And I said, you know, that hi-hat sounds particularly great, which is probably the way you play it. And he said, well, yeah, this one's kind of old. And I went, what do you mean kind of old? He said, well, you know, Ed Sullivan show. And the other musicians in the band were kind of going, having heart attacks. And they wanted to like kiss the cymbals and bow down, you know. And for Ringo, he's just like, oh, I'll play this one today. It's amazing.
You've said that the British Invasion was 90% the Beatles and 10% everyone else. Don't bands like the Rolling Stones or the Kinks deserve a slightly higher percentage?
Yes, I was exaggerating for effect. We're allowed to do that. It's show business. But yes, it was an exaggeration. But I do think that the idea that the role, you know, that it was a huge collaboration between all of us is an exaggeration. The Beatles did it, and we all followed in their footsteps. Without the Beatles, I don't think any of it would have happened.
You're listening to Leonard Lopit at Large on WBAI New York 99.5 FM.
Please lock me away and don't allow the day here inside. Where I hide with my loneliness, I don't care what they say, I won't stay in a world without love. Birds sing out of tune and rain clouds hide the moon. I'm okay, here I'll stay with my loneliness. I don't care what they say, I won't stay in a world without love.
We're going to get back to Peter Asher in just a moment. We're talking about his career and also, well, inspired by a new book from Henry Holton McMillan called The Beatles from A to Z, reminding us that even though Peter Asher has lived in the United States now for something like 50 years, he still says Z when he is going through the alphabet. He doesn't say
well,
Z.
You know, it's I'm English originally, and it's about an English band, so I figured that's why I insisted that they keep English spelling throughout the book, which they did. I've got all the proper U's in there.
Color spelled C-O-L-O-U-R.
Color.
Labor. L-O-B-O-U-R.
Absolutely. And there's a lot of ones people don't think of, like Traveler has two L's. Mm. Jewelry has two L's. You know, I made him put all those in. So why would I miss out the title? So The Beatles from A to Z, yes, we didn't even know about Z until we started learning about America. And until it showed up in an American TV show when we started getting those. We were going, Z, what is Z?
Well, a lot of our listeners, I'm sure, are learning a lot more about what happened in England at the beginning of the rock and roll era than they would have imagined if before they listened to this show. And if you're one of those people who thinks that this is good stuff, we hope that you will support us by becoming a member of WBAI. Just going to take a couple of moments, Peter,
please,
to ask for support, because in England, the BBC is funded by a license fee.
A compulsory license fee, whether you listen to it or not. Yes.
Or watch
if
the TV.
If you have a radio or a television,
And we are on the honor system. We go to our listeners and say, if you listen to this station and you want it to continue, please support us by giving us a call at 516-620-3602 or going to our website, wbai.org, and following the instructions. And we hope that you will say that you're becoming a member in the name of Leonard Lopate at Large. And we're also asking, we're trying to focus on getting BAI buddies, $10 a month, $15 a month, whatever you can afford. It helps become a sustaining member. It helps us to plan for the future, and it doesn't take a big chunk out of your budget. But if you could see a way to $100 a month, we would not say no. The important thing is to help us keep going. We don't take ads. We don't take foundation grants, and we don't have a license fee. The government doesn't give us any money. It's just you, our listeners, 516-620-3602, or go to our website at wbai.org. I'm going to go back to Peter Asher. The Beatles started their own record label in 1968, Apple Records, and you became the head of A&R.
Yes.
Now, what motivated the band to start a label? Were they unhappy with EMI and Capitol?
I think they thought that EMI's attitude and the attitude of all the labels at the time was dismissive of popular music, which it was.
But they were making a lot of money off of the Beatles.
Yes, they thought that The popular music made them a fortune, but they still thought it was kind of their God-given duty to use that money to support classical music or their radar business or all the other stuff they had going on. And, you know, they did look disdainfully. They looked down their noses at popular music, despite the fact that it was one of their major sources of income.
Well, were they pressuring the Beatles to record in certain ways? Did the Beatles want more freedom?
No. The Beatles just thought there should be a label available to other people that would provide opportunities and freedoms that otherwise seemed unattainable.
Although they wound up being distributed by Capitol and EMI.
Yes, well, that was because, obviously, first of all, Capitol and EMI owned Capitol, wouldn't want anybody else to get involved with them, and it gave them the opportunity to put the Beatles records nominally visually on Apple Records, which gave Apple a huge visibility. They weren't really on Apple Records in the same way that someone Apple signed would be, but it was more of a courtesy label stuck on top.
What guidance did the band members give you about the kinds of artists that they wanted you to sign as the A&R man?
We just wanted good and interesting stuff, and I would have A&R meetings, you know, with the Beatles once a week, or as many of them as were around. And we, you know, I had a staff of four or five people listening to the huge influx of tapes we got. And the sad part was, you know, we actually took an ad saying we are the first record company that says we will accept unsolicited contributions. We will listen to everything we are sent, which we did.
Is that how you found James Taylor?
No. This is the sad part of the story. The stuff that got sent in was awful. I mean, it was really depressing. It was more likely to be some guy with 100 pages of lyrics that John was supposed to write music for that didn't even scan or make any sense, things like that. It was grim. We got nothing from that huge quantity of tapes. I found James quite separately and independently.
He's an American. How did you wind up with him in England?
Here's the story. The key figure in the story is a guitar player called Danny Kortchmar, who you may be aware of, a great, great player, great record producer. Danny had been in a band called the King Bees, who had backed Peter and Gordon on a couple of our U.S. tours. I loved his playing. He played like Steve Cropper, one of my heroes. And we got on very well. We became firm friends, and we stayed in touch after the Peter and Gordon touring period was over. I used to stay with him and his wife when I went to visit Los Angeles and so on. So we stayed in touch. He was subsequently in a band called the Flying Machine with his childhood friend, James Taylor. They'd known each other since they were 10 or 11. James's first ever musical thing was a duo with Cooch called Jamie and Koch when they were 12, I think. And they were in this band called the Flying Machine. It was a New York-based band. It was enduring every vicissitude New York has to offer, you know, which is to say they were broke, they were starving. They had a record company that made half an album and disappeared. Several of them were strung out on drugs, including James and so on. So the band broke up in dismay. And James decided to go to London because he had a girlfriend in London he thought he could stay with. Turned out he couldn't. That's another story. But when Cooch realized James was going to London, said, "Oh, look, I've got a friend in London. You know, I used to play with him. He's okay. Here's his phone number." So James called me out of the blue and introduced himself as Cooch's friend and came over. And he'd made a demo tape in London a few days earlier, played me the tape, and I went crazy. It had Something in the Way She Moves on it. It had Something's Wrong on it, Knocking Around the Zoo. I was going nuts. I go, how can this guy not have been, like, discovered already? And we had this odd conversation, which was really me going, "Look, this is a strange coincidence. I've just been made head of A&R for a brand new record label. I have the right to sign people," which I did. And I said, "Do you want a record deal?" And he said, "Yes, please, I'd love one." And that was that.
But I
had to tell him whose right label it was.
And then he must have freaked out when he heard. But I suspect that even James Taylor's biggest fans wouldn't recognize the recordings he made at Apple, even in some cases with the Beatles playing on them.
Yeah, one Beatle. Contrary to what a lot of people believe, George actually didn't play on anything or sing on anything, but Paul played bass on Carolina in My Mind, yes. Because I loved that song, and I thought Paul would play a great bass part on it, which he did.
One Apple act that's gained considerable fame in the years since their albums were released is Badfinger.
Yep.
Did you play a role in bringing them to the label?
Yes, in the overall sense, not the same way as James. James was entirely my discovery in the showbiz vernacular.
You said they were hanging around the studio.
Well, no, Mal Evans brought them in. Mal Evans, who was the Beatles' tour manager, a roadie, brought them in as the Ivies. not Badfinger. Mm-hmm. And we made one album as the Ivies. We liked them very much. Mal was right. They were good. They had a very minor hit in the UK, nothing in America. And then, for reasons I don't quite remember, instead of just making another record, we decided to change the name of the band, and that's when they became Badfinger.
When did you first get the feeling that it was probably time for you to move on?
Oh, the instant I knew Alan Klein had won the war. You know, there was a big discussion going on between the Beatles that they knew they were needed to bring in a new business head because they'd lurched into movies and electronics and clothing and all this other crazy stuff. And the company was hemorrhaging money and needed some big time sorting out. And John was super impressed by this Alan Klein guy. And I knew about Alan from friends in New York, had already told me that he was pretty much a crook, you know, as well as being a very smart guy. You can be both. And Paul had other ideas, and particularly maybe his father-in-law, John Eastman, Lee Eastman, who would have been an infinitely better bet all around. But anyways, you know, John won the argument. He got George and Ringo on his side. Alan Klein came in. Once I knew Alan was arriving as our new boss, I resigned. So I missed the actual day of Alan's arrival. And that's when James agreed that he wanted to leave Apple too.
And you both moved to Los Angeles.
And we agreed that I would become his manager. No, I moved to Los Angeles. James didn't.
Oh, you didn't?
No. I dropped James off on the East Coast, actually, for a bit of rehab he was in the mood for at the time. And he stayed on the East Coast. He came to L.A. to record, but James actually never lived in L.A., which is ironic because he's associated with being part of the L.A. sound, but he's never been an L.A. resident.
Well, he was homeless for a while, and you put him up in L.A., didn't you?
Yes. I mean, when he came out to L.A., he stayed in my house. But when he arrived in London, he stayed in my flat. Once this girlfriend didn't materialize, he ended up moving into our London flat for 6 months. But he still had places he could live on the East Coast, and he had, you know, his parents and all that stuff.
So now you've moved on to producing as well as performing.
Yes.
Were you influenced by what you'd learned from George Moore?
I think so. I tried to be. I mean, I admired what George was doing. I learned a lot from George about timing and, you know, when to step forward and start interfering vigorously, or when to step back and let the artists make their own decisions. And, you know, I think a lot of a producer's job too is can be knowing when to stop. You know, it's when to, you know, if you're working on a particular song and you're doing multiple takes and it's still not sounding right, there's a point we have to go, let's try another song, or that song's not very good, or let's rethink the arrangement, or let's hire a new band for tomorrow, or whatever. You know, and the same goes for overdubs. You know, an artist sometimes left their own devices will keep overdubbing. And nowadays, of course, it applies to things like plugins, you know, not to get too esoteric. But, you know, people say, oh, I put another 3 plugins on that. It'll be great. How about take off the 8 you've already got on there, you know, and see what you actually started with. And if that sounds terrible, you're probably doomed. You should do it again with a good microphone or something, you know. But I think, and the same goes for mixing.
Well, you know, I can't imagine a record like Sweet Baby James being made today.
Well, I could do it in a second.
No, but what I mean is,
give me the new James Taylor. I will make that record for you in a week, just like the other one.
Yeah, well, you must have. Did you know when you were doing it that you were creating something very special?
I knew James was brilliant, and I knew that I hadn't got it quite right on the first album. So I assembled this very small group. We knew we wanted Danny Kortchmar. I'd found a drummer called Russ Kunkel who'd never played on sessions before. He did a lot afterwards. I found him at a rehearsal for John Stewart. Do you remember John Stewart? The ex-Kingston Trio songwriter, not the TV guy. And I heard Russ playing, and I went, now he's the drummer who's been listening to Ringo and his plays with sensitivity and is brilliant. You know, he's not trying to be Hal Blaine, but is trying to be Ringo. And so I hired Russ to play on the session. And the piano on that record, as you may know, is all Carole King. Mm-hmm. I'd heard Carol's demos of all the incredible hit songs she'd written, and I loved her piano playing because it wasn't jazzy and it wasn't sort of folky. It was really just straightforward singer-songwriter, just what's needed piano. So,
was she already writing songs?
Oh, God, yes. Yeah. I mean, don't forget, Carol, when she was 18, Will You Still Love Me Tomorrow was number one around the world. So by that time, now the Beatles were huge Goffin and King fans. I mean, it was Will You Still Love Me Tomorrow and Up on the Roof and The Locomotion and Natural Woman and I'm Into Something Good and, you know, crazy, Crying in the Rain. You know, songs that we all loved before any of us made it. Crying in the Rain was an Everly's hit. long before Gordon and I ever made records. So, no, she was. We knew she was a genius writer.
So she was willing to just be a sideman on a record?
Exactly. She said yes, and she'd never heard of James, and I invited her over to my house. She came and met him for the first time, and I just encouraged them to just sit down and play, and it sounded great. So I went, okay, we've got a band. And we used two or three different bass players. Because Fire and Rain, actually, interestingly, is upright, bowed bass. It's not there's no bass guitar in there at all. So I used several different bass players. But the key band was Russ Kunkel, Danny Kortchmar, and Carole King. We made the whole record in 2 weeks.
Well, did you ever produce anything by her?
No. I managed Carole for quite a while. But I produced a lot of things that she played on, so I feel like I did. But no, I never actually produced the Carole King record. But unless you count James and Taylor and Carole King live at the Troubadour, because I produced that. So I guess change my story. Yes, I did. But it was a live record, which is a bit different.
You also had significant commercial success for your work producing Linda Ronstadt.
Yeah.
Is it true that you got that job because of James Taylor's sister, Kate, recommending you?
Indirectly, but in a roundabout route. No, I'd met Linda after she played here in New York at the Bitter End. Somebody told me to go down and see her. They said, you've got to go and see this woman. She's got the most amazing voice you've ever heard. And they did also mention, incidentally, you know, she sings barefoot in these really short shorts and she's insanely hot. And all of it was completely true. And so I met Linda afterwards and then discovered, on top of all that, she's one of the most erudite, well-read, well-informed, intelligent, thoughtful women I've ever met in my life, and remains one of my dear friends. And so I ended up, she was in the middle of finishing a record, and it was a bit muddled, had two or three producers. I ended up helping her with that. The Kate thing was slightly different, because at the beginning, John Boylan, who was looking after Linda at the time, but was not her official manager, he asked me if I would be interested in managing her. And I actually, the first time I was asked, I said no, because of Kate, because I was managing Kate. So, but then Kate decided that show business was not for her at that time, though she's back singing now and doing fantastically well. But so she, and she actually said to Linda, I'm not going to, you know, Peter's, I don't need a manager anymore. You should call Peter again. So yes, Kate was the final icing on the cake.
So Peter Asher's my guest. So you were producing, you were also managing.
Yeah.
Do many people wear the...
No, very few. And that's that whole Rolling Stone thing where they did a story on me, that was the essence of it, is that they thought it was... Because people kept asking, isn't that difficult, you know, managing and producing? And I went, no, it makes, you know, the relationship
one
between the producer
just slides
and the manager
into the other.
The producer and the manager have no arguments. You know, it makes life very simple.
You also produced J.D. Souther, Bonnie Raitt, later Cher, and 10,000 Maniacs.
Yeah.
And you also were one of the partners in a theater in Los Angeles with David Geffen.
Yes, the Roxy. Yeah, we started the Roxy together.
Is the Roxy still in
it
operation?
It is flourishing. Yes.
So, but this is a wide range of styles.
Yes.
Was that part of the fun?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the thing I like about producing is your job is to make the best particular record that artist should make. So I've never had a formula. So I'm not, you know, you couldn't recognize a Peter Asher record the way you could a Phil Spector record, where there's a sound to it. If anything...
You've never gone to jail, as far as I know.
I never murdered anybody yet, you know. There's always time. No, I think if I was given a style, it was usually some of the vaguely derogatory comment about my records being too perfect and things like that. Oh, it's all too clean. And I was going, well, yes, you know, I kind of don't like mistakes, you know, but I usually take them out, fix them. There was a certain neatness, I suppose, that got associated with my style overall, and because those Linda records were, I made them very precisely, because to my mind, the genius I wanted to focus on was her singing, which was, which was precise in a highly emotional and atavistic kind of way that I loved.
You once produced Joni Mitchell, an artist that you've also described as impossible.
No, I didn't actually produce Joni. I managed Joni. Oh. Pretty much no one's ever produced Joni. Larry Klein did, you know, some records with Joni, which he did masterfully. Mm. But Joni has always been her own producer. Mm. David Crosby produced her very first record. On that occasion, his job, which he did perfectly, was to prevent them putting strings on it. They wanted to turn her into Judy Collins. David basically sat outside the studio smoking a joint, saying no. And it was perfect. That was a masterpiece of production.
Well, Judy Collins is terrific, and oh, I Joni love Judy. Mitchell is terrific.
Don't get me wrong, I love Judy, but yeah. It was just that her
different
versions
styles.
Of Joni's
but
songs.
But I see where people would have wanted her to be like Judy. In 2002, you won your third Grammy for your work on a Robin Williams comedy album.
Yes.
So how do you produce that sort of thing?
Robin and I we're close friends. He remained one of my very best friends till the end, and we miss him enormously. And he was talking to me about his comedy album, and he asked me if I'd like to help. And essentially, what that consisted of is we recorded every show on about a 3 or 4 week tour, and I made very extensive notes of which bits. There were certain things he tended to do every night, and I would make notes of which bits were the best of each, and so on. And in addition to that, he would do the first 10 or 15 minutes of the show would be about the city he was in, and it was fascinating to watch that process. From the moment we landed, he would be talking to the limo driver, the porter in the hotel, the woman behind the desk, about what's going on in your town, what's the mayor up to, what's the scandal, what's the football team doing. And he would accumulate all that stuff, and by showtime, there'd be a 10-minute routine on that city. So what I did was keep notes of all that stuff, and we ended up making it a CD of the best versions of all the bits he did every night, and then a second CD of an edited combination of all the cities we'd played across America with little stories about each of them. Ah. So putting all that together took a lot of time, and I don't think Robin has the patience for that. So essentially, I would do all that listening. Robin's wife, Marsha, would help, and who had a lot of great ideas. But essentially, it was a listening, editing, commenting, and putting together. And I did also try to capture some of the movement of his show. In the way we recorded it, we added in a sort of stereo element, even though, of course, Robin had one mic on him, which you had to use. But I also mic'd various other places on the stage because he paces back and forth a lot. And I wanted some of that, if anyone could be bothered to listen on headphones, that you'd get some of that vibe, too, you know, of him, his energy moving around the stage. So, it was a quite different job than producing a music record.
And then 2 years ago, you began hosting a show on Sirius XM Radio's Beatles channel.
Yeah.
Has that experience led you to any new discoveries about the band and,
oh, yes,
and your past?
Yes, because I look stuff up. People can keep saying, oh, your memory is amazing, all the stuff you put in the show. I go, no, my memory sucks. And I look stuff up. I research things, you know, and that will help me remember, oh, right, you know, they did that on that day, and I think I was there that day. And it stimulates your own memory and your own recollections. So my show is sort of an overview of things that people do already know in many cases, because obviously, as you know, there are historians and researchers who have delved into this stuff to a molecular level, you know.
Well, they have to pick your brain if they're doing any research.
Well, they do, but, I mean, the things they, you know, there are researchers who write about, you know, when George changed his guitar strings between which takes and, you know, and that stuff, I have no idea about that. And neither, by the way, do the Beatles. You know,
sure.
They don't even, all this thing about which bass did Paul play on such and such a track, he doesn't know. You know, but there's people who do. They figured it out somehow from photos, and you know, it's like detective work. And so I've used some of that stuff. I read all those things, and it helps me because I was there for some of it, make it a little more real because I can add some moments of actually, well, I was there and it felt like this. But am I? When people say Beatles expert, I always go, no, I'm not. You know. Beatles fan, Beatles who had luck at the good fortune of occasionally being around while stuff was happening or talking to them about it, absolutely yes. But there are Beatle experts like Mark Lewisohn and all those people, you know, writing volume 97 of, you know, of the Beatles history that know everything, and I don't.
Now, we have just a few moments left, but I wanted to talk about performing. You still perform on occasion.
Yes.
You performed with your old partner, Gordon Waller.
Yep.
More recently with Jeremy Clyde of Chad and Jeremy fame.
Yes. Cause
do you wish that you could have done more performing over the course of your career?
No. No, I think I'm pretty happy with when I did and when I didn't do it. You know, Gordon and I stopped when I went into record production and management full time, and for 27 years we didn't sing together. And I used to sing a lot on records I was producing, so I still sang and played, you know, rhythm guitar
Oh, you performed on records as a background, backup musician,
oh, yeah.
And a singer?
Yeah, quite a lot.
Ah.
If you look on James albums and Linda albums, I'm always there somewhere.
Huh.
quite apart from the inevitable tambourine overdubs, there's me singing quite often.
But do you still get a charge? Why are you doing it then?
Because what happened was...
Now it's Chad and...
Gordon and I got back together for a benefit here in New York. It was Paul Schaefer who actually asked us to get back together. He was doing
the Tonight Show Letterman
show. And yes, and he asked us to get back together. He was doing a British Invasion-themed benefit for a keyboard player friend of his. And that was the beginning. And then Gordon and I enjoyed it. So we did a few more gigs until Gordon died about 10 years ago. And at that point, yes, I thought, am I never going to sing these songs again? Or can I figure out a show which would enable me to do them and tell some stories? And that's what I did. And then the Jeremy thing, of course, was that with Gordon already gone, Chad Stewart decided to retire. So Jeremy and I looked at each other and went, well, what the hey? People who was always confusing the two of us anyway, let's finally be Peter and Jeremy. And I get to sing Yesterday's Gone and Summer Song. He gets to sing Well Without Love and Nobody I Know, and we both have fun. So I do that from time to time as well.
So now you've recorded, you've produced, you've managed, you have a radio show.
Yep.
And now a book.
Yes.
What's left?
Well, I'm not sure, actually. Well, it'll be interesting to find out. I'm hoping there's something, you know. I don't know. But,
you're going to run for president? You can't run for president. You're not an
American
citizen.
I wasn't born in America. I could pretend. I could lie. It's all the rage these days. I could just lie. I was born in America. What do you mean? No, I would love to be president.
Born in Kenya, I know.
That's right, exactly. But the funny thing is, another question people sometimes ask is if you hadn't happened into this world, what would you be doing? And I actually originally wanted to be a member of parliament. So the correct answer to the question is, by now I would be prime minister and we wouldn't be in this mess we're in today. And we wouldn't be doing Brexit or any of this nonsense. But that's another story.
Peter Asher's book is The Beatles from A to Z, published by Henry Holt and Company and Macmillan. What a pleasure it's been having you on our show.
No, it's been great. Thank you. Really fun. Great questions.
And that brings us to the end of today's show. Special thanks to my executive producer, Jesse Lent, who produced this segment. If you're new to this program and you like what you've been hearing, you can access past show streaming on demand at WBAI.org. We're also available as an iTunes podcast. And don't forget to check out Leonard Lopate at Large on Facebook and Twitter. Also our website, leonardlopateatlarge.com, where you can find links to all of our past shows. We are preempted tomorrow for WBAI special programming, but we'll be back on Monday, so have a great weekend. And as I said earlier, our pledge line is active once again, so why not show your support for Leonard Lopate at Large by making a donation of any amount right now by calling 516-620-3602 or by going to the website WBAI.org and following the instructions. And we hope that you'll consider becoming a BAI buddy. That allows us to plan for the future. If you become a BAI buddy for a sustaining member for $10 a month or more, we will know that 6 months from now, there'll still be money coming in. We won't have to go on the air again and ask for more money. And remember that BAI is supported totally by its listeners. We do not take foundation money. We do not take government grants. We do not run ads. Other public broadcasters do. And in England, they have a licensing fee. For us, it is all just you to help us pay for our antenna, the phones, the equipment, the electricity, the rent. And ever since WBAI was knocked off the air for a month by a rogue faction at the Pacifica Network, the need has become even greater. We need your help just to get the facilities back to the level they were before the station was taken over. And a reminder that the number to call is 516-620. I got it. Jesse, thank you so much. 516-620-3602, or you can go to our website, WBAI.org, and we hope that you will become a member in the name of Leonard Lopate at Large. And the best, we hope that you'll make a contribution of any amount. If you can see a way to becoming a BAI buddy by making a sustaining monthly donation in the name of Leonard Lopate at Large, we really will appreciate it. We really do appreciate it. Whatever level you can contribute at, the important thing is that you step up and give. And we thank you all from all of us here at Leonard Lopate at Large for your generous support.